right. It is, once again, that magical time of year. There is a crisp chill to the air. The leaves are changing colors for some of you, depending on where you live. Around me, they're just turning brown. There are holiday traditions just around the corner, family gatherings coming up. I know everyone's very excited. There are a few sounds that are particularly common to this type of year. And if you close your eyes, I think perhaps you will be able to envision these scenarios that I'm going to describe for you. So the first one is the sound of a Salvation Army Santa standing in front of a store collecting change. Can you see it? How about the sound of a choir singing Christmas carols? Can you envision it? All right, perhaps the sound that most of us can identify with most is the sound of the man in the cubicle next to you hacking up a lung because he's caught whatever it is going around the office again. Can you picture that? Can you picture that with me? I imagine that you can. Everybody, I am Dr. Patrick Leva. Welcome to another episode of Health Matters. Tonight, we are going to be talking about the flu. We're going to be talking about measles. We're going to be talking about all kinds of fun things. And we have got joining us today, Dr. John Vancheri. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Dr. John Vancheri, as many of you, I'm sure, are aware, has hosted the show several times. And he's going to be talking to us about infectious disease because that's his thing. Let me read off a few of these impressive accolades. First of all, Dr. Vancheri is the Vice Chair for Pediatric Research at LSUS and the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease Fellowship and Pediatric Infectious Diseases. He went to the Baylor College of Medicine, did his residency at Baylor College of Medicine, and graduated from Emory with a PhD in neuroscience. Good gracious. So, two doctors in the house. Dr. Vancheri, how are you today?
Doing well.
Have you had your requisite number of pumpkin spice lattes yet this fall season?
No, not my thing.
Oh, it's not? Man,
no, sorry.
I
did have a pumpkin spice Kit Kat today.
A pumpkin spice Kit Kat?
That was new.
What was that like?
Different.
Preferable to the actual Kit Kat?
Not even close.
I have a fun Kit Kat fact that maybe we'll share a little bit later. All right, Dr. Vancheri, so we've got all sorts of stuff to talk about. You are the master of infectious diseases. And we also, before I get started too far into this, I'll just let you know, if you want to call in anytime, 1-800-552-8502. We would love to have your questions on the air. Dr. Vancheri would love to answer them. I would love to answer them if I know them. I may not, but that's okay. You can call in and try to stump us. That's always sort of fun. We have Google, so we can look it up with you. It'll be a great experience. Dr. Vancheri, as you know, there will be a few times throughout the show where I will interrupt you and we will begin our trivia show where you and I get to do a little bit of trivia back and forth.
Of course.
I'm excited about that today.
Yep.
But first of all, let's talk about the flu. Okay? We're in flu season. So what does that even mean? What is flu season?
Flu season usually follows right on the heels of the beginning of gumbo season, which is my favorite season.
Oh, man.
And that is the wintertime especially. Now, flu season officially starts somewhere in early to mid-December, usually.
Okay.
But right now, we're in flu preparation time, and we want to make sure at this time, everybody's getting their flu vaccines. And flu vaccines are recommended for kids starting at age 6 months.
Okay.
All the way up to 160 years old.
Wow.
At least.
Wow. So, I guess we'll talk about that for a minute. So 6 months old. I mean, like, are we talking like take them down to the Walgreens and get a shot just like mom and dad get?
No. It's a different shot. Little kids need a different flu shot than adults need. And so children older than 7 can get a flu shot at the pharmacy. But most kids either get their flu shots at school or with their primary care provider. And for young children and infants, that would almost always be at their primary care provider.
Okay, so a good thing to visit your pediatrician this time of year.
Pediatrician, family medicine doctors, exactly.
Awesome. Now, I know there is an intranasal vaccine. I've heard about this. Correct. I've never been the recipient because they always just give me a shot at work and I don't question it.
Well, yeah.
So explain to me the difference here. Why wouldn't I get the intranasal or why would I? It seems like if I can just sniff something, that would be preferable to a shot.
Sure. The intranasal flu vaccine was made available close to 10 years ago and was doing very well. And particularly for young children, it was a very effective vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we all know, the flu strains shift over time and they drift over time. And what happened is that the intranasal flu vaccine became less effective.
Okay.
And so 3 years ago, the vaccine advisory group at CDC recommended that not be used because its effectiveness had dwindled. And just this year, there is new data available, suggesting to us, number one, why that happened, and it was because of particular mutations in the flu virus, that were difficult to detect in the normal realm. And then the other piece is that this newer data says that the newer batches of flu vaccine with that include that particular problematic mutation are now effective. That being said, we don't have full data, and the Academy of Pediatrics hasn't fully endorsed using that nasal spray vaccine at this point.
Okay, so it was in favor for a little while, fell out, maybe coming back.
Probably coming back. I think we're going to know that by the end of this year, really, because we'll have good data.
So now you've actually said a couple interesting things, and I think you take it for granted because you have a PhD and an MD, and you're very intelligent. You pointed out that the flu changes, and it changes every year. And I think that brings up a good question. Why do I have to get vaccinated for the flu every single year? So I got like a tetanus shot, what, a decade ago, and they don't tell me I need to get a new one. I mean, what's going on here? Why do I need to get a flu shot every fall? Am I not safe?
So the flu viruses that circulate do change from year to year. And in fact, when you consider other germs, like tetanus, it's actually a bacteria, and we actually are it's a different mechanism of vaccination in that case. But measles is a good example. We haven't had to change the measles vaccine since the 1960s when it was first developed, you know, over 60 years ago. So some viruses do mutate much quicker, shift and drift much quicker, whereas something like measles does not. And that's just a part of the life cycle of the virus. It's its strategy to stay ahead of us. And also is part and parcel of the fact that many flu viruses come from animals, especially birds, sometimes pigs, and there are strains of flu that are endemic in those different creatures that sometimes can cross over into humans.
Okay.
So there's a whole lot of things involved there.
So just the variety, this particular type of virus is one that has a tendency to change more often, and that's what's causing us to need this new vaccination. So it is actually important to get it every year.
It absolutely is. Now, there are many, many researchers working on what we would call a universal flu vaccine, and that would be a vaccine that would direct our immune response, direct kind of that fire alarm to know when to fight it to an area of the measles, the flu virus that doesn't change from year to year. That strategy sounds great.
That does sound great.
Then we wouldn't have to
get one shot. I could stop getting a shot every year.
Exactly. But what we, you know, that's not far enough along really for prime time. Those are in early research stages.
Okay. Well, very interesting. We're going to get to the measles a little bit later because that has obviously had a little bit of a resurgence. But let's talk a little bit about just, I don't know, I guess the flu in general. So the flu, I think, gets used a lot. You know, people come in and they're like, I've had diarrhea all week. I've got the stomach flu.
Correct.
And then some people are like, my muscles are so sore. I've got the flu. And then another guy's like, I've been sneezing all week. This is the flu. Like, what is the flu? Right. When do I have the flu?
So the flu is really a relatively small family of viruses. Mm-hmm. Influenza is their official name.
Right.
And they come in sort of different flavors and with different accoutrements associated with them. So we call them serotypes and strains of like H1N1 that was the pandemic flu. And you can say that's a particular flavor. That's chocolate with nuts and cherries.
Okay.
And then there'll be another H3N2 that's actually really strawberry with, you know, Jimmies and gummy bears on it. And so they look a little different to us and like that description. And they also look different to our immune system. And so the vaccine we get is actually usually a combination of now four different flu viruses go into that vaccine, two of A type and two of B type.
What are the symptoms of the actual flu? I mean, are they the same? H1N1, is it the same symptoms as H3N2?
By symptoms, no one of us can distinguish those, and because those symptoms are, you know, nasal congestion, runny nose, kind of that head cold feeling, especially sore throat.
Mm-hmm.
And with the flu, a very specific symptom is fever.
Mm-hmm.
Adults who have the flu usually have fever associated with it. And that helps adults distinguish between a common cold and influenza.
Now, this is going to be a subject of much contention. I want you to define a fever for me. Because I know you've had it. I know I've had it. Someone comes in and they say, I've had a fever. And you say, oh, okay, what was your temperature? And they're like, 99.1.
Right.
Normally, I run 95. And you have to say, no, this is not true.
Right.
What is a fever, Dr. Ben Cherry?
A fever is an abnormally high value mm-hmm. in one's own body temperature.
Okay.
So for some people, 99 is a mm-hmm. fever because they normally run 97.
And all right, so we're getting that permission.
What is normal for humans is clustered very tightly around 98.6, but it's a little different for males and females. It's a little different depending on where a woman is in her menstrual cycle, the time of day, it varies for all of us. So there are a lot of things that affect that. In general, the guideline we use is that for adults, if it's above 101, it's a fever.
Sure.
And that's the kind of body temperature you're looking for typically with the flu.
Okay, so 101.
101 to 102.
Theoretically, in the ENT clinic, we always say, you know, 100.4. Like, that's the magic number. If you hit 100.2, you don't have a fever. If you hit 100.4, fever.
But that also varies with age. So for an infant less than a month of age, 100.4 is kind of our action level.
Right.
If they are 100.4 or above, we're more worried about an invasive bacterial infection. We're going to do blood work and other things to evaluate them. Mm-hmm. Whereas a 99 in an infant of that of less than a month is not so worrisome.
Right. So it is. So it is kind of what you think about. It's like a head cold, but the distinguishing feature is fever.
Fever. Right. Now,
in adults.
In little children, lots of viruses will give them fever because there are lots of viruses they still haven't seen before.
Sure.
Whereas you and I have seen lots of viruses called paraflus and adenoviruses and metapneumovirus and respiratory syncytial virus, and I can name 100 others that our bodies have seen before, so we don't mount as big of a inflammatory response that includes a fever.
Sure. Sure. Let me throw out the number again there, 1-800-552-8502. We're in the studio talking with Dr. Van Cherry tonight. We're discussing currently the flu. We'll be on measles later. Vaccines in general are up for discussion, and we will talk about those sort of maybe more generally later. So now you've said it's like a cold, but maybe it's a little more potent cold.
More severe. So with flu, you're going to have, and the muscle aches are a significant part
of
that.
Myalgias.
Myalgias, we call it officially.
It's that doctor word.
And that's more common with influenza type B compared to influenza type A.
Mm-hmm.
Again, those are nuances that don't really change our approach or necessarily our diagnostics to
it. So now you said it presents a little differently in children. So maybe what should I look for? You know, if I'm an adult, I already know, myalgias, fever. But what about if I have a kid? You know, I have a 3-year-old. What do I look for?
In children, it can be very it's almost impossible for a parent, and sometimes even the doctors, to distinguish flu from other viruses. And so most physicians will use a rapid influenza test in their office. Some will use a panel of testing that looks for 20 different viruses.
Yikes.
And that, of course, tells you, you know, where on the map they've landed. And from a clinical perspective, though, flu is a more severe infection. That is, kids are more miserable.
Sure.
Appetite suppression is greater. They're just not feeling well. The head cold is worse for a lot of these kids. And they're just a lot droopier is the pediatric term.
The droopy kids.
Yeah.
So you got to watch out for the droopy kids. Now, this is the where the rubber meets the road. I'm a parent. My 3-year-old has a cold. I don't really want to go to the emergency department because, you know, it's a 4-hour wait. That sounds miserable. Mm-hmm. When do I need to anyways? What's that one? What's the thing that you would see in a kid and you'd go, nah, go to the ER?
Right. So that's always a challenging question.
Yeah.
And it's often a judgment call for old guys like me who've had 6 children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more comfortable
Watch them for a little while. Well, you're also an infectious disease specialist. So
I have a little bit of background.
They're at the doctor already.
So the major things are if your child is not drinking fluids, and as an indicator of are they drinking enough, are they actually urinating enough?
Okay.
And that's probably the best objective indicator of when it's time to definitely go to the doctor. If your child is just, you know, really droopy, hasn't drunk much of anything for 3-4 hours, hasn't urinated in 5 or 6 hours, that's sort of the time. Yeah, it's time to go to the doctor, especially consider the emergency room depending.
So.
Now, it's the judgment of when to go in the middle of the night to the emergency room as opposed to waiting to the morning to see your regular primary care doctor. That's a little harder call, and primary care doctors are really what we want to be the first line of seeing these children because they can make the diagnosis, they can assess the hydration status, decide about antiviral drugs.
So before even going to the ER, you think, you know, if you can make it to your primary care,
that's the way to
go. So your family medicine doctor, your internist, your pediatrician, whatever that may be.
And let me just add another thing. If the child is having difficulty breathing, like they just can't catch their breath.
Always to the doctor.
Right.
Immediately.
I mean, yeah, that's a do not pass go.
No, that's the thing in the ENT world is when they call us and they want us to show up immediately, they say, there seems to be an airway problem. They're having trouble breathing because they know we'll speed and break the law to get there. I actually have a caller for you, Dr. Great. Vancheri. I've got Jenny from Richland Hills. Jenny, you are on the line.
Hi. I'm sorry, I missed the first 5 minutes, so if you already addressed this, I'm sorry, just tell me in advance. But I wanted to ask you this question instead of my doctor, because I didn't want him to look at me funny. I heard you talking about the universal, like a long time from now, universal flu vaccine. I get my flu vaccine every year, my kids are vaccinated, but they have all of these propaganda things about vaccines will be the next thing that causes zombies or it causes things in your kids. Is there any medical basis for all of this? That kind of thing? Because it always worries me. I get them, but it always worries me.
Well, Jenny, thanks for your question. This is a common question that I get. And the bottom line is that the vaccines that we use are extremely safe. And I can say they're safer than they've ever been. So compared to the vaccines that I got as a child, the vaccines now are much safer, and they are also much more effective. And so there's no need to worry about your child or grandchild having, you know, becoming a zombie because they've gotten flu vaccine by any means, or having any severe consequences. Now, we know that a shot like the flu vaccine, it's going to cause your arm to be sore, and some children and adults even will have a little low-grade fever after, perhaps, but those are tolerable and minor reactions, and they shouldn't dissuade you from the vaccine.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
Sure.
Jenny, thank you so much for calling. We always love having people call in. Again, 1-800-552-8502. If you have any questions for Dr. Vancheri, or you just kind of want to shoot the breeze with him, you know, you've got a pediatric specialist here. He can't run away. I've got him for at least another 45 minutes. So we've talked a little bit about what the flu, you know, what the symptoms are, when to go to the doctor. So what happened last year? Because we all got the shot and we all got the flu. What went wrong?
Right. So last year was the biggest flu year since the 2009 pandemic,
wow,
which was the H1N1. And that's in terms of number of hospitalizations, mm-hmm, and the number of deaths. Over 80,000 people died last year related to,
yikes,
influenza, pneumonia this time of year.
Okay.
Most of those deaths are in elderly.
Okay.
And but we know last year was also a record year of pediatric flu-related deaths. And there have already been flu-related deaths reported in children this year.
Wow.
The vast majority of those children, 70% or so, have no known chronic illness or reason to get so sick from the flu. And so that's an important point. These are normal, healthy kids,
right, they were just
that the
bebopping along,
will take them down. And that, to me, as a parent and a physician, is one of the most compelling reasons, mm-hmm, to get vaccinated, because kids are at risk. The other thing is that when the flu vaccine is not used as widely as we'd like, mm-hmm, and again, it's recommended for everyone 6 months of age to 160 years of,
right,
age, when we're not getting good uptake of flu vaccine, there is more flu activity in the community. And we did see that. Last year, the numbers of older adults who got flu vaccine was lower than in prior years. So you end up with a confluence of things.
Right.
The lots of spreading of the virus and a population that's not fully vaccinated.
Hmm.
The other piece that's really critical to this is that there are super spreaders of the flu, and they're toddlers.
Oh,
toddlers have more flu virus in the mucus in their nose than anybody else.
That's,
and they make
horrifying.
It, and they're really good at spreading it to other people, especially people who are their grandparents.
You know, you just never see toddlers washing their hands.
Well, it's challenging.
Yeah.
But when they have that kind of glazed donut look on their face, you know, that's not the time to be in their face kissing them and loving on them and the like. And so.
Gotcha.
Several things can happen. We should vaccinate our toddlers, mm-hmm, because we want to make sure those super spreaders are not,
right,
so super at spreading flu virus. And then we want to make sure grandma and grandpa, older adults, are protected by vaccination.
Yeah. Now, something just dawned on me is that earlier you said you had six children.
That is true.
Holy mackerel. We'll get into that. That'll be another episode. We're going to talk about reproduction and like fertility. And we'll have you on as a...
All wonderful, great blessings.
So what is it about the flu that gets people, I guess? You know, you've just described it kind of like it's almost like a big cold. So why is that killing anybody?
Right.
What about the flu kills people?
Yeah. So there are a few aspects that we don't fully know. But what we do know is that most people who die from the flu... Right, or at least half, it's because the flu virus has in some way damaged their lungs, mm-hmm. and then allowed a particularly bad bacteria like
sure.
staph
okay.
or pneumococcus, streptococcus mm-hmm. pneumoniae, to then take hold in their lungs and be much worse than it would have been in
sure.
the past.
So it's
right?
not necessarily even the flu. It was like the flu led to the thing.
The flu itself can be very problematic, but it's also those secondary infections, we call them, the bacterial things that come into a damaged area of the body and cause infection.
Now, if mom has some extra antibiotics lying around and Jimmy starts looking like he's got the flu... I mean, that makes sense, right? Shouldn't we use some antibiotics for that?
No. Antibiotics only do one thing. Antibiotics kill bacteria. They don't kill viruses. And so we want to be certain that antibiotics are prescribed appropriately to the person who needs them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big deal, because the more we use antibiotics indiscriminately, the bacteria are trying to stay ahead of us. And
right.
so we end up with these super germs called
right.
resistant bugs
mm-hmm.
and resistant bacteria. And then those are more problematic because we have fewer antibiotics to use to treat those when we have to.
Right.
So you definitely don't want to just throw antibiotics at a virus, because they won't do any good to the virus, and they have secondary effects. They can have cause other symptoms and effects in the GI tract. They change your microbiome. They let other germs come in and be problematic. So there are a lot of reasons why we don't want to just reach in the medicine cabinet and use some leftover antibiotics for people that don't need them.
And, you know, antibiotics, I think the big takeaway is antibiotics don't work on viruses.
Exactly.
And I think that there's a exactly. common misconception that while you're sick, something's right. infecting you.
Right.
Antibiotics must be the trick.
Right.
And they're not.
That's not true. Right.
They are not.
So for viruses, we need antiviral drugs. We call them antivirals. And
antivirals.
There are some for flu, and there are some for other viruses like herpes viruses and the like. But those have to be used a little differently.
Yeah.
We want to make sure of the diagnosis before we start those. We can use those for prevention of flu. So if one member of the household has the flu, we know there's at least 25 to 50% likelihood that other members of the household will get the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can use drugs like oseltamivir or Tamiflu to prevent other household contacts from getting
it. I was going to ask about Tamiflu. Yeah. That was actually yeah. my next question. What is Tamiflu? Does it work?
Tamiflu is the one of the most prescribed anti-flu drugs. It does work.
Mm-hmm.
It reduces the shedding and production of the virus, so it slows down the transmission from person to person. It helps prevent people from getting the flu, and it reduces the duration of symptoms for the person who has flu by a day or so.
Well, that's awesome. So that actually does work. Now, you said you had to start it early, right? You can't just start it immediately? Or you can't start it whenever? Can't be whenever
in the
track? Correct.
Its greatest effect is if you start within the first 24 to 48 hours of symptoms.
Okay.
Then there are a few other flu drugs available now, some by IV that can mm-hmm. be used in hospitalized patients. Others, a new one recently approved by the FDA for children 12 and older and adults that is a little bit available this year. It's not widely available yet.
Okay, so, looking for that in the future.
Yeah.
All right. So it is time for our regular quiz show.
All right.
Dr. Vancheri, I'm excited. Today we are playing another ripoff version of the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me show. That's not my job. Today's episode is titled Marco Polio.
Oh,
you like what I did there. So today we're going to ask Dr. Vancheri questions that he has no reasonable reason to know the answer to. And it's themed around children's games. All right. So children's games. So listeners out there, you can try to get these right as well. In this one, this is a little bit different. Normally I give you one true answer and three false answers. In this case, I have three true answers and one false answer, and you have to pick out the false answer.
All right.
So we all had a number of toys which were near and dear to us as children, but over the years, there have been a number of unusual toys that have hit the market. Which of these outrageous toys by popular toy manufacturers is a fake? Now, I want you to know that for the purposes of this question, I excluded any toy that was produced and sold only in Japan, because there is a bevy of really weird children's toys in Japan. But these were all sold and marketed in America by major toy companies. So is it number one? The Playmobil hazmat set, complete with hazmat suit-wearing figurines, radioactive barrels, and vacuums for cleaning up the radioactive mess. Is it the Mega Apatosaurus, which was by Fisher-Price, and it was essentially just a giant dinosaur with rocket launchers attached to it, which I don't know what was supposed to represent, but other than just awesome. Was it, again, by Playmobil, number three, the Playmobil security checkpoint with baggage scanner, x-ray machines, and various places to put your luggage, teaching children that anxiety, teaching them early about the anxiety that results from almost missing a flight? Or number four, also by Fisher-Price, so we've had two Fisher-Price and two Playmobil, the Choose the Verdict set, which came with 12 jurors, a judge, and a man in a striped suit, and you get to determine if he's innocent or guilty. Three of these are real.
Wow. Well, gosh, you know, the Hepatosaurus sounds real, so I can definitely say that's not the answer you're looking for.
Okay.
The hazmat deal, yeah, we might have actually had one of those.
It may have been a hazmat suit. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm an infectious disease doctor, and we
That seems realistic, right?
Yeah,
realistic,
you know,
enough.
But sometimes ID docs like to put on a hazmat suit before they go see patients. So, security checkpoint, that one I don't know. That sounds a little fishy.
The security checkpoint is actually a real thing. I don't know how many they sold.
Wow.
I can't imagine. I think that there was actually also an airport check-in set that you could buy extra. No, the one that is not real is the Choose the Verdict set. Although, that being said, you know, it may exist somewhere. I expect somewhere in Japan it is probably an actual toy.
Well, that's fascinating. But they don't have a 12-man jury in Japan, right?
Oh, I actually don't know. Do you know the size of a jury in Japan?
I have no idea.
Oh, man. Callers, 1-800-552-8502. Someone let us know how many people are on a jury in Japan. Now, this is actually something that my producer wrote out, and I kind of wanted to talk to you about this, so we're going to transition a little bit. So, 2 days ago, CNN reported that according to the New York City Department of Health, measles had been diagnosed in 17 children in the Orthodox Jewish community in the Williamsburg and Borough neighborhoods, and this was in Brooklyn. The infected children have ranged in age from 7 months to 4 years old, and some have experienced complications, but there have also been no deaths so far. Now, three of these children contracted measles on a trip to Israel, where there has been a really big outbreak this year. And the outbreak in Israel is believed to have been caused by tourists and visitors who brought the disease to an unvaccinated population comprised partly of ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. So, I mean, the measles, we talked about this a little bit earlier. The measles vaccine hasn't changed since we came out with it, in the 40s? 60s, excuse me. I wasn't around in the 60s, so I can't speak to those times. But it hasn't changed since it's come out in the 60s. So what's going on? Like, why is this happening? What is it? I feel like there's been a lot of measles in the news lately.
So measles, yes, has been in the news lately. And part of the what we know about measles is that it is considered the most infectious agent known. That is
really,
yeah. That is, it's easier to catch measles than virtually any other pathogen.
Is that based on? I mean, what? Just number of particles
based
required?
On the number of virus particles it takes to actually make you sick. And so, I'll give you a good example.
Okay.
Several years ago, there was an outbreak of measles, and of course, there was the big outbreak in Disney, but near the same time, there was a smaller outbreak where a person traveled to Europe, mm-hmm. contracted measles, and was just beginning to get sick as they landed in an airport in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in an area for a couple of hours of layover before they went to their next flight. And people who simply walked through that area within the 2 hours of the person with measles leaving the area actually got measles.
So the guy wasn't even there anymore.
The guy wasn't even there anymore, but the measles was still hanging around. It's spread
cow.
By the respiratory route.
Sure.
We breathe it in,
mm-hmm.
and it takes very little of the measles uh-huh. virus to actually cause the disease. Now, the cool thing is the vaccine against measles is extremely effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so measles, you know, if you want to personify it, measles is really good at finding the people who aren't vaccinated.
Right.
Or the people who can't be vaccinated because they're have an immune problem
sure.
of some sort, right? Okay. So this virus continues to be an issue, resurging. In Europe, they've had more measles cases this year than any of the past 5 to 10 years. There's mm-hmm. a lot of measles in Europe, and it's primarily related to lack of vaccination.
So, first of all, what are the symptoms of measles? You know, we hear measles. I think that's a great sickness to write on a note for your teacher, like Jimmy had the measles. But what are the measles?
Right.
Would you know measles? Would anyone listening to this know the measles if it was sitting next to them? I kind of doubt it. So what are the measles?
So most people less than 50 have never seen a case of the measles because
yeah, sure.
it's been vaccinated
since the
away.
60s, as we
right.
learned. Not
right.
the 40s.
Not the 40s.
The 60s.
So the important thing about measles is that it is a severe childhood infection,
mm-hmm.
and kids will have high fevers, and they'll have congestion, nasal congestion that mm-hmm. you might not be able to distinguish from flu or other
sure.
things, and then they break out in a rash, and the
right.
rash typically starts in the head and works its way down, and that's because the virus is actually, you know, spread throughout almost the entire body.
Right.
The challenging thing about measles is that about 1 out of 1,000 children who get the measles die of it. So it is
pretty high when you consider how infectious it is
compared to many other things we also deal with. Measles is considered a severe childhood mm-hmm. Illness. 15 years ago, the number of children who died worldwide of measles was over 1 million every year.
Wow.
Because we've been able to vaccinate more in underdeveloped countries, those numbers have come down by almost half. So we're at more like 500,000 now, which is incredible from a public health perspective.
Right.
But so measles is a severe disease.
Mm-hmm.
It is highly infectious, highly mm-hmm. contagious. And grandparents will remember it.
Right.
Right. They'll remember measles, especially in the wintertime, and schools being closed, people being sent home and quarantined because of measles mm-hmm. in the area. There are a lot of public health interventions that happened in the community level because of measles. And by the way, whooping cough and rubella
sure.
and streptococcus and other things
right.
you know, that we don't commonly do now because we vaccinated them away.
Now, I'm trying to think how to ask this tastefully. So we're all, you know, we in the medical community are all about vaccination, you know, herd immunity, theoretically. You hear the anti-vaxxer arguments, and there's, you know, the people going back and forth about all that stuff. But to some degree, why should I care if somebody else gets vaccinated? I'm vaccinated. What does it matter? Like, am I going to get measles just because Jimmy didn't get vaccinated? Jimmy is always my example. It's either Jimmy or Susie. So, Jimmy, I'm sorry for beating up on you out there, but why does it matter?
So, why does it matter? Well, when you're dealing with highly infectious agents like measles, they have not just an effect on you, and if you're not vaccinated,
mm-hmm.
it's not just that you get sick because you're not vaccinated, you spread it to other people.
Right.
So its public health ripple effect is significant.
Sure.
And so we call those secondary and tertiary cases are very high numbers when it comes to measles in an unvaccinated population. So that's why the outbreak you describe in New York City is not very surprising in a relatively tight-knit community with a lot of folks who are unvaccinated
right.
Or incompletely vaccinated. Once measles gets there, it spreads like wildfire.
Right.
Right.
And then 1 in 1,000 die.
And that's part of what we're dealing with. Now, you know, the decision to vaccinate is for some parents a difficult decision. Parents mm-hmm. are worried that the vaccine is going to harm their child.
Right. That's been a big thing lately. There's
right.
poison in the vaccines.
Right.
It's causing autism. You know, the one caller said earlier, maybe zombies.
And all of that has been, you know, scientifically thoroughly refuted.
Mm-hmm.
The vaccines, as I said to Jenny earlier, are safer than they've ever been. And their track record on safety is phenomenal.
Right.
Much safer than driving a car.
Sure.
You know, lots of things we do all the time and take for granted. And so to malign vaccines as causing these widespread problems is really hyperbole.
Now, why do people do that? Where did that get started?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon that when something bad happens, we like to attribute it to something else, right? So
it's residency all the time.
So, you know, if a person develops cancer, mm-hmm. well, 15 to 20% of cancers are caused by viruses. We can prevent a lot of those with vaccines like the HPV vaccine. But we tend to want to have an explanation for why something bad happened.
Right.
And medical science hasn't gotten there yet that we can explain every event as either genetic, environmental, toxic, infectious, or all these different groups, right? So we want to place blame on something.
Mm-hmm.
One of the difficulties is that when it comes to childhood immunizations, the schedule includes multiple childhood immunizations. And
right.
So,
like every 3 to 6 months, I mean.
So 2, 4, and 6 month vaccines is the regular series for infants, and then a booster at 12 months. And so things that are temporally associated in time often get picked on or pulled up as, well, he'd gotten the vaccine 2 weeks ago, it must be because of the vaccine.
Right.
Right. And so we have a natural tendency to do that, a temporal association. But that does not tell us there is a causal association.
Right.
And we have to really separate those things out. And when you separate them out scientifically, any association other than temporal goes away. And so there's no evidence of a causal association for these things.
Okay.
Right. I will say, no vaccine is 100% perfect.
Sure.
They don't all 100% protect. But influenza vaccine will reduce the severity of the illness, reduce the likelihood that you get the illness if you do. And those are all positive things.
Now, something like, I mean, I guess what I guess the other thing I was getting at, you know, there was a study that came out that started this whole hubbub, right, that was like, yeah, it has been disproven now. Like, it's come out multiple places
and
in multiple
and
ways.
And retracted as falsified science.
But I feel like that was sort of the impetus for this whole movement. And maybe it started before that, but I feel like that was a big push in the direction of this anti-vaccine movement. And I think that a lot of people, you know, we live in an age where it's hard to know fact from fiction. I mean, half the people that you see get their news from Facebook or from Instagram, and you know, maybe it's reliable, maybe it's not. It's hard to know. So, you know, you get on your Pinterest and there's all this group of moms who says, well, we're not vaccinating our kids because it causes autism or it causes, you know, whatever. Then all of a sudden, you know, that's part of your sphere of influence. It's hard to just deny that, because then you get on, you're like, well, the CDC says this, but can I trust anything that the government says? Look how crazy all the stuff in politics. You know, I feel like there's just these, there's so many spheres of influence that are against you, and it's so hard to know in modern times what's true.
Right. So you do have to be judicious in your choosing your sources of information, verify things that are outlandish at times, and understand that some bad things do happen.
Right.
Not because of anything we've done or not done, but just because
Sometimes they happen.
And I
think it's also interesting to note, like you said, because you said, you know, it's hard, you have to be careful about how you choose your sources. But even that one source that a lot of people referenced back in the day has been retracted. So, I mean, even if that was the only source you were trusting, that same source came out and said, no, this wasn't right. We're bad. Our bad.
Right.
So I think that that's, you know, it's not like two sources are arguing about it. The same source said, no, this was an error. So interesting to know. Now, What about something like this? So this is kind of an interesting concept. This is looking at the vaccination rate in Mumbai. 95%. Still had a measles outbreak. Why? 95%.
Well, so a few things. One is that in many countries, the vaccination may not be complete. So we know it takes 2 doses at a year and 4 years to get full measles protection. We know that prior to a year of age, when, you know, before kids are able to get the measles vaccine, they're susceptible. And so those are other influences. And there are, even in a place as big as Mumbai with high vaccine rates, those people who are susceptible remain susceptible, and this virus will find them.
It'll find them.
It's there, you know, that's just part of this.
Like you even said, I mean, 2 hours later in the area the person had been, not even still is.
Right. More infectious than tuberculosis, syphilis, pick other big public health things. Measles is much more infectious.
That's, I mean, kind of flooring.
Yeah.
All right, now, of course, because I'm playing my music again, that means I get to ask you another question in tonight's game, Marco Polo. So, I've got a pick here. I've got so many good ones. All right. Which of these wacky board game origin stories is accurate? So, Hi-Ho Cheerio, a game perhaps you've played, was created by a cherry farmer who was frustrated by falling cherry prices in the market and wanted to supplement his income, so he came up with a game and marketed it to his community. It turned out to be a hit. Chutes and Ladders, originally a Hindu game where you attempted to land on a virtue space, then climbed a ladder towards Vishnu, or you could land on a vice space and slide towards the belly of a waiting snake. Pick Up Sticks, originally a peasant game for obvious reasons. You just pick up a pile of sticks. Somehow it caught on. We don't know how it kept going. And then Shooting Marbles was actually started in a ball-bearing factory where slightly imperfect bearings that weren't going to be sold were knocked against each other and people made bets on making certain shots.
Ooh. Wow.
I know.
All very plausible. So you're looking for the one wrong
this
one
is the
right
one? Only one of these is actually true.
Yeah.
The others I lied about in my spare time, which is what I, you know, I do
you
in my free time.
Of, So I'm going to drop out Hi-Ho Cheerio.
All right. I like that one, but that's fine.
And Pick Up Sticks. I think it's Chutes and Ladders.
You are correct.
Bada-boom.
Maybe in the first time in the history of this game, like, you are correct. Chutes and Ladders, originally a Hindu game, landing on a virtue, climbing to Vishnu, or landing on a vice and sliding towards the belly of a waiting snake.
There you go.
Much more innocent now. Just climb a ladder and get some candy. I think that they took all the spiritual implications out of it. All right, so, I mean, we've talked a little bit about measles. We've talked a little bit about the flu. This one is very interesting to me. So this polio-like thing, I think it's been in the news a lot. It's been really hyped. People are freaked out about it a little bit. So this acute flaccid myelitis, this, what is this?
What is that? Okay, so acute flaccid myelitis is a syndrome. It's a constellation of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a new syndrome. It's not a new constellation of symptoms, okay? So 50 years ago, 60 years ago, polio caused a disease called acute flaccid myelitis.
So maybe explain, what is polio?
So polio is a virus. We've largely vaccinated it away in the vast majority of the world, except for a few countries, and due to under-vaccination in those countries. And but polio would cause a virus infection in the spinal cord, and it would particularly attack neurons that are necessary for controlling your arms and legs, especially the lower extremities. But for some people, it would attack higher up in the spinal cord.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have trouble breathing.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to be in a what we used to call an iron lung, like an iron box to help them breathe, instead of putting a tube permanently in their neck to breathe for them.
Sure.
So polio was a terrible disease, and it would come in epidemics every 2 years or so, or 3 years in between, and comes in waves, and it would be especially bad in the summer and the fall. The polio virus is one that is shed in our feces, and inadequate sewage treatment is one of the major reasons that polio persisted in the human societies.
Okay,
so polio we've largely eradicated. Now, other viruses can cause a similar disease, acute flaccid myelitis, which is a disease that if you see it in an adult, you would think they're having a stroke because one arm or one leg or both are weak and they have weakness.
Right.
Maybe a facial droop like you see sometimes in stroke patients. Maybe a little non-clear thinking, a little change in their personality or affect can go with that. But it's mostly the weakness of one extremity.
Right.
So like I said, in an adult, the first thing we think of is stroke, right?
Right. I mean,
and that's right.
Ad campaigns about knowing about strokes.
Know
Be
about
fast.
Stroke. So this disease, acute flaccid myelitis, is a syndrome that occurs mostly in young children.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about kids, 3 to 7 or 8 years of age. CDC has been monitoring this and studying it, not just monitoring, but really studying it for the past nearly 10 years because it seems to be coming
kind of ramping up here.
Greater numbers every other year. So last year there were 30 or 40 cases. The year before that, 150 or so cases. The year before that, 20 or 30. And so it kind of has a pattern of cycling like that.
Everything seems to reference 2016 as the year where it was like this kind of the big crop.
2014 there was a big problem. And And so there are a good number of viruses that can cause this. West Nile virus can cause this syndrome.
Okay.
But for the kids that are being diagnosed with it now, West Nile virus isn't the answer. It's something else.
Sure.
And in the large outbreak in Colorado and Missouri, Kansas, in 2014, they identified a particular virus called an enterovirus and a particular flavor of that enterovirus called D68. Now, you and I both know enteroviruses are a huge family. There are almost 100 different enteroviruses.
There's like a ton of enteroviruses.
And so they are a relatively common virus as a family. But this complication of enteroviruses is very rare. This is a 1 in a million kind of outcome from a common virus.
Okay.
Now, the cases that I've been involved with.
Have you seen some here in Shreveport?
We have taken care of 3 cases here.
Wow.
CDC is investigating those cases, so they haven't confirmed by their case definition that they are. But we have seen 3 cases that are very suspicious for the same syndrome.
I mean, it has very specific diagnostic criteria.
Right.
But.
And so we are working with the state public health lab and the CDC to evaluate samples from those patients as well as their MRI scans and their clinical features and the like. And the symptoms are, as I described, weakness of an arm or leg or both, and that kind of has a slow onset. Sometimes for young children, they may have tingling or painful sensations in advance of the weakness.
Right.
And so they may say, well, Mom, my arm has pins and needles. And well, Mom figures they may have slept funny, or Dad says, well, just, you know, kind of shake it a bit and get the blood flow back in
it,
you know,
fix it.
Kind of thing. And
buck up, kid.
We'll see how it goes. But then when it doesn't go away or it progresses to weakness, then obviously something's different out of the norm, right? So the cases that we've seen have been like that. They are weakness in arm, leg, or both. Sometimes both legs. Children have trouble walking if they have weakness in their legs, or even progress to the point where they can't stand up. And we haven't seen any cases more severe where kids have trouble breathing, but sometimes this disease can affect the muscles needed for breathing.
That's the big one. That's, I feel like you see that, and that may be some of the confusion is, you know, you get these like polio pictures and there's a kid in a wheelchair and then there's a kid in an iron lung, and it's just based on how that particular virus affected that person. It's the muscles that became weak.
Correct. And so remember, or you won't remember, we had a president who had polio and who couldn't walk.
Right.
Yeah.
Was that Wilson? Who was that? I'm terrible.
FDR.
I'm sorry. Okay. Look at this. I was an economics major, people. I would just like to point out.
Really? New Deal?
I didn't do a lot of history. I actually took
that
one. I have a really funny story about. Yeah, economics is theoretical, though. We don't talk about historical economics.
Right.
No, we talk about future. Well, I have a funny history story I'll tell you sometime.
All right. So we largely eradicated polio, but there are other viruses that can cause a similar syndrome, and we're seeing more. CDC this year has said they're investigating over 200 cases of polio-like illness, acute flaccid myelitis, in children. They've confirmed over 90 of the cases so far
in
30 different states. But again, the important take-home is that this is a very rare complication of a common virus.
Okay.
Even the cases that we've seen are not all from, you know, one area of town. Actually, they're spread throughout North Louisiana from, you know, people who have no association with each other. They go to different schools and again, magnifying that this is a rare complication of a common virus.
So something parents should be aware of, but not necessarily something parents should be afraid of.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Nothing to be done to prevent it really either.
And good hand washing just prevents so many things.
Good hand washing. How about hand sanitizer? Purell.
Hand sanitizers
not a sponsor.
Are good. Soap and water is even better.
All right, you heard it. Soap and water is even better. Now, we're approaching the last 10 minutes, and I know you wanted to talk about this thing, vaccinate before you graduate.
Yeah.
What is that?
So vaccinate before you graduate is a campaign push led by Governor John Bel Edwards' wife as the champion, and it's really a push for two things. One is for teenagers to get more involved in their own health care and to sure. understand their body and vaccines and the importance of vaccines. And number two, to encourage providers and parents to make sure that that before kids go off to college, their immune system is ready, because when you change your mm-hmm. location of living, you're going to be exposed to new germs. And so we want to make sure that that before kids go off to college, their immune system is ready to fight off the germs that are new for them and that they'll be exposed to in college. So things like meningococcal disease,
sure.
we know rates go up in college age.
Right. It's one of the vaccines you get before
individuals,
you leave.
That's right. And so now the recommendation is for a booster dose at age 16, and we know that the rates of getting that booster dose are not where we want them to be. They're only around 40% to 50%
wow.
in some areas. And so we want to make sure that teenagers are taking ownership of their own health mm-hmm. and advocating for their own health, understanding these things, their body, et cetera, and encourage them, because it's much easier to get those vaccines before you leave mom and dad's house than after you go to college.
Sure.
And you may or may not be able to get them at the college health department, health unit, health hospital center, whatever it may be, or it just may be much more difficult. So
now, what about, you know, it totally makes sense. You're going to college, new example. What about if I'm not going to college? What if I'm just, you know,
going to
get a job?
So it turns out that the risk of these germs, like meningococcal disease, mm-hmm. meningococcal meningitis, are independent of whether you go to college or not. And there's some studies that actually suggest that kids who don't go to college may have higher rates. So,
wow.
There are other factors that play into that.
So don't get a job, don't go to college.
No,
that's the safest thing you can do.
You want to actually, you know, vaccines are like a fire drill for your immune system, right? Just like in first and second grade, they taught you if there's smoke, you go to this door, you go right, you go left, and then you're out, right? It's what to do if the bad guy comes.
Right.
That's exactly what vaccines do. It's telling your immune system, if you see something that looks like this, this is how you need to react to control it, right? Vaccines, seat belts, motorcycle helmets, those are all in the same prevention realm, and we should think of them as so.
Right. So if you're the kind of person that doesn't wear a seatbelt, then, you know, don't bother with a vaccine. Actually, we already talked about
it.
Seatbelts are cars are more dangerous than vaccines, so you should get the vaccine and
much more.
Not wear the seat. I don't know. We'll do them both. So now, what about people who have like not gotten their vaccinations up to this point? You know, I'm 16. I'm Jimmy, and my mom has not gotten me vaccinated, and now here I am. I'm 16. I'm going to take control of my own health care. That's kind of embarrassing. Is it too late? Can I even talk to anybody?
Definitely not too late. And actually, we had a great jump over the past year in completion rate and initiation rate for HPV vaccine in Louisiana.
Wow.
We were significantly below the national average.
As per usual.
And in just a year's time, we moved up to significantly above the national average.
No.
Amazing. Yeah, like 7 or 8 points above the percentage points above the national
average.
That's
fantastic. Good job, Louisiana.
It's a great thing.
Texas, you're listening. We can't speak for you.
That's going to put, you know, ENT docs who do head and neck surgery on head and neck cancers, it's going to slow your business down in 10 or 15 years, which is a great thing.
I get worried about that sometimes.
Yeah, well.
Should I be concerned?
You chose your profession, you know. So
got to get better at tonsils.
Yeah. So that's a huge thing that we know there are thousands of kids who are not getting fully vaccinated, still thousands who haven't initiated their HPV vaccines, don't get meningococcal vaccines. We really want to make the public aware, make parents aware, and teenagers that now's a great time to do it. Get those vaccines, catch up. You don't have to start over. The number of when we first had HPV vaccine, it required 3 shots. Now it only requires 2 shots because mm-hmm. we know that's just as efficacious, effective, and durable, lasts a long time.
So. And I think I would just give encouragement to anyone that's out there listening. I feel like there is sort of an idea that your doctor's going to judge you if you show up and you're like, I haven't actually gotten any vaccines. That's not true.
No.
We don't care. We are happy to help. We want you to come in and talk to us about it. I can't tell you how many people have told me things and they say, you know, I just feel like I'm embarrassed to bring this up. And I promise, it's not embarrassing. Talk to talk to your healthcare provider about it. We want to help. And I especially got to give a plug for the HPV vaccine because, you know, we joke about going out of business. But the truth is that would be the best reason to go out of business possible.
Absolutely.
Like, the HPV vaccine is one of the few vaccines that is literally a cancer prevention vaccine. I mean, it prevents head and neck cancer. It prevents cervical cancer. It prevents all kinds of stuff. And I think it's, you know, regardless of it, more so than anything else, it is a cancer prevention vaccine. And that would be a fantastic thing.
Yep.
I mean, we've seen the swap. We've seen the changeover from the number of head and neck cancer cases caused by smoking and tobacco being overtaken by the number of head and neck cancer cases caused by HPV, a preventable virus.
Right.
And it's mind blowing.
Yep.
And we could take care of that.
That's right. And the HPV vaccine is, I would say, unequivocally one of the most effective vaccines that we've ever had.
I mean, that's fantastic.
It's a phenomenally effective vaccine and a phenomenally safe vaccine.
Right.
It's not a new vaccine. We've been using it now for 10 years.
10 years. It's been around since I was in college.
Over 200 million doses have been used, and its effectiveness and safety are impeccable.
I mean, it's fantastic. So I just would encourage anyone out there, go talk to your doctor. You know, figure it out. Nobody likes shots. Shots are the worst. I understand that. I hate getting shots. But I'm telling you, it's worth it. It's a one-time thing to prevent you from having a life of misery. I mean, you think about like this, like the measles, not the measles thing, but like the polio thing. Polio is eradicated. And you think about the people whose entire lives, the course of their life was changed. FDR, if we're going to be, you know, learning about history here. You know, the entire course
history
of their...
History matters.
History does matter. This is health matters, but history matters will be on next week. But I mean, the whole course of their life was changed because they were unable to prevent this. And you have that ability at your fingertips to prevent this.
Right. So, and 100 years ago, 1918, pandemic flu killed a higher proportion of the human population than any known pandemic. That's 100 years ago.
And that's, you know, we have vaccines for that.
That's right.
You can go get a flu shot today.
Yep.
I mean, it's not too late, is it?
No, not at all. Not too late. And I think it's, I always like to tell people that, remember, Thanksgiving is the most traveled holiday in the United States.
Right.
And that's a great time when all the germs get reassorted between people in all different parts of the country. And then after that, it gets to be winter and all heck breaks loose because these viruses have been reassorted. So get your vaccine as soon as possible. It takes a full 2 weeks before it has its full effectiveness. Now's the time to do that.
Oh, that's a great point. I didn't think about that. Get it before you travel.
That's right.
Dr. Vancheri, we're running out of time. It has been phenomenal as always. I have one last question to ask you.
All right.
I know. Hold on.
We have to thank all those people who called in.
We do. I think we had
Jenny. All right.
Thanks, thank you, Jenny. I didn't give out the number as much as I should have. 1-800-552-8502, but it's really too late. Let me see if I can find my last questions. Let me see if I've got it. Here we go. Here we go. Red Rover, a common, if not painful, modern playground game. Which of these Red Rover facts is true? We got to go fast. It was popular with young adults in the Victorian era as it allowed physical contact with a member of the opposite sex. More emergency department visits for children occur on an annual basis from playing Red Rover than from skateboarding. Red Rover was originally a colonial taunt of British troops, calling out imperial forces for cowardice and referencing a common term for British soldiers in their infamous red coats. And the origins were pagan, whereupon members of satanic cults would call upon the spirit of Red Rover to allow the souls of a loved one to come and partake in a seance.
No, it's colonial.
It's colonial. Ah, I wish it was colonial. No, it was popular with young adults in the Victorian era. They wanted to, you know, hold hands, but they weren't allowed to.
All right.
Dr. Well. Vancheri, it has been a pleasure. 1 out of 3 for our show is really not bad.
Well, yeah.
It's pretty good. Dr. Vancheri, thank you. I know we will have you on again. You've been a guest several times. Phone helpers tonight are Sheila Lawrence, Wally Derleth, and Tim Snell. Health Matters is a program for informational purpose only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Phone assistance was provided, already talked about that. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation, also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Patrick Glavo. Thank you for joining us.